Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
It's The Breakdown. Jamali Maddox with The Hook.
Do you know what? I need to shout out Cool Keith for doing the intro music on that. That is some dope shit. Like, I was, they asked me, so who do you want to do the intro? And I said, Cool Keith. And I didn't think he would do it, but he did. So that's the intro. I like, you know, he's rapping about, I've got bionic arms, which is this dope as fuck. But yeah, today on the podcast, I've got Stuart Lee coming down. If you don't know Stuart Lee, you need to get to know. He's, I mean, you know, he doesn't like it being said to him, but he's a very influential comedian. I remember I've been watching his stuff before I was doing comedy. Since I was maybe about 15, I've been watching his stuff, and we have a good chat, and I'm really looking forward to him coming down. I know he doesn't really do a lot of interviews, so the fact he said he would do my podcast, which is crazy. It's a weird feeling doing this. What's been going on with me recently? I filmed Live with the Apollo yesterday, and it went fine. I didn't get booed off. Was on the tour. I was in Latvia, Estonia, Finland, and Norway. Oslo has become my new favorite city. I've put that up. I'm putting it out there. Oslo has become my new favorite city. The women are beautiful. Everyone goes, oh, the women are so beautiful. And you go, I'll be the judge of that. And you go there, and it's like, you know, the type of beautiful women that make it, you know, you speak to me, you start stuttering. It was great. Really enjoyed it out there. Had some fun shows. And I'm going to be on tour. And I'm on tour currently. I don't know when this is going out, but I'll still be on tour when this goes out. So go to my website, www.jamalimaddox.com. Go on my Instagram, Jamali Maddox. On my Twitter, Jamali Maddox. Ooh, Jamali Maddox. And yeah, come catch me on fucking tour so I can pay some bills. I've got shit to pay for, you know? So yeah, and this is the podcast. I'm gonna stop rambling now. I've been rambling too much, but people will probably skip this. Come see me on tour, and I'm introducing now Stuart Lee.
Jamali,
how you doing, man? Thank you for coming.
Mate. Thanks for having us.
I really appreciate it. Because when I heard that you said you would do it, man, it was a great moment.
Oh, cheers!
I really appreciate it. Because I've been watching your work for a long time.
Right. Well, I'm very old.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember the first time I heard about you, I must have been about 14, and it was the Channel 4 100 Greatest Comedians.
Ah, right.
And you came up on the list. And I remember, like, I had watched, and I was watching, and that's where I found out about Bill Hicks.
Right.
And that's kind of what made me want to do comedy. That's when I started thinking about doing comedy. So I must have been about 14 before I did any sets.
Yeah.
And I remember watching, and then you did your special.
Yeah.
And I saw it. I think it was it called
41st Best Stand-Up Ever.
Yeah, well,
I was really surprised to be on that list at all at the time, because there was loads of brilliant people on it. And also, I hadn't, there wasn't much stuff of mine that you could see. I hadn't done a lot of stand-up on telly, so I don't know who voted for it. So I was really surprised to be on it and pleased, and also it was a huge help. But also I thought that the best thing for the character to do, you know, would be to think 41 was just, what is that? It's like,
yeah,
nothing,
yeah,
is it? It's,
yeah,
not,
yeah, yeah.
It's not in the top 10. It's not 41 seemed like a really funny position to be at in a list of things. So I called the next tour 41st Best Stand-Up Ever, which was a sort of way of having your cake and eating it. On the one hand, it's taking the piss out of the whole idea, and being 41st is, you could come to this, but remember, there are 40 better options. But also, it was sort of a thing of way of going, oh, you know what, I'm in the top 50.
It was
weird though. I was really surprised. I didn't really have any idea that I would have got beyond being liked by sort of broadsheet newspaper critics. So,
I was young at that point. At that point, you were just mostly doing the Edinburgh Fringes.
Yeah, I did.
You had left the club at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I started doing stand up in about 88, 89. And I did circuit gigs kind of 5 nights a week through the 90s. I was in a double act which wrote for radio with Richard Herring.
Yeah, yeah.
And we did 4 series for BBC Two that kept getting recommissioned, but they never really tipped over into being critical or ratings hits. Although actually the ratings by today's standards would have been really high, you know.
Yeah.
The problem with those was we'd get paid for them and then Avalon would put us out on tour and we'd lose all the money we'd earned from the thing. So it kind of, at the end of it, I remember the series got cancelled and there was an option to what are we going to do next? And the weird thing was we couldn't really afford to do anything because Avalon model for touring meant you'd lost money all the time. So that sort of just dribbled out really. And then luckily I'd always been doing stand-up all the way through it, and so that kind of got moving again for me, which suddenly seemed like the best way of doing anything really.
Because so in the 90s that was like the boom era. That's when there was like more, because from what, and it's like, yeah, weird because when I'm in the green room, yeah, there's nothing better than when an older comedian goes, oh, you should have been there back in the day, it would have been great.
Well, it sort of was. I mean, look, you know, on a practical level, when I came to London in 89, I was in a shared house with 4 people. The rent was £50 a week,
yeah,
right? And if you got 4 circuit gigs, there weren't 2,000 people. There weren't thousands of people doing a circuit. There's about 200, right?
Yeah.
And 150 of them were in London, and there were 5 in each other major city. And within a year, you knew them all. And within 2 years, you knew everyone's act so well.
Because
everyone only did 20s, really.
And no one really turned over because there wasn't that much TV.
No need. And I remember there was a night at Market Tavern in Essex Road where everyone used to do each other's act. It's really funny. And like Jeff Green did Joe Brand and whatever, you know.
That's
and
funny.
The first person to write a long form show that made sense was Sean Hughes in about 1990.
And that's when he won.
Yeah, that's when he won. Yeah, and so around that time, if your rent was £50 a week and you were 21 and you had 4 circuit gigs a week, which were cash door splits, let's say they were £50 tops, you were fine, right?
Yeah.
And that now, everything's much more expensive, young people more in debt, lots of gigs don't pay anything because there's so many people doing it, it's privileged to perform. So it's sort of, you know, it is different, but it was kind of like what it was like in the 90s, 80s, 90s, talking to people from the 60s that I know on the folk circuit, was like being folk, you know, when there was a folk boom and there were lots of, you know, women and men playing guitars and mandolins, bungees and the troubadour in Fulham and just kind of getting by like that. It was like no one thought they were going to be rich, but everyone was just
working,
you know, it was just ticking over. And so, and doing the circuit, doing circuit gigs 5 nights a week then, it was a fantastic decade. You met so many different kinds of people, you know, and you went to all these little tiny weird clubs around the country that would only be one in every town, and it wasn't yet the Jongleurs or the Comedy Store. And so it was, you know, it's a fantastic education. And also the era of the travel lodge hadn't really taken off, and so you'd be in £8 a night DSS bed and breakfast, but you could do it, you know. And so it was, I do feel really nostalgic about it, actually. Sometimes I think it would be really great to write some kind of comedy drama about that period, but I don't think people would believe how unglamorous it was.
I guess it did lack the sort of showbiz element into what people think showbiz is.
Yeah, and also there wasn't the internet, right? So, you know, the way you promoted a gig was you photocopied a piece of paper and stuck it on a tree. People came, you know,
it does show the difference even just in generational of like me doing comedy and how you were doing comedy.
Yeah,
I think how the fuck would I get to a gig without Google Map and a sat nav, like, because it was maps and like if I'm doing a gig in Birmingham, I wouldn't even know how to even get to the gig in Birmingham.
In the 90s and 80s you had minicab driver knowledge of going all over to these places but it was different, and I don't know that it was better or worse. It was just different.
Well, I think it's just different. Yeah, yeah. I think it's just it is the change of the times. And I think it's easy to be, you know, and you should be nostalgic because it was a good time in comedy. But in the same time, it is, you know, things change. But one thing you did mention, which I think is something that isn't great in comedy, and for people coming up, because people always ask me, you know, how do I get into comedy? And I tell them, well, the first thing is don't do it.
Yeah.
That's the first one. And then if you're going to do it, then you just got to, you know, properly do it. But there is that thing now of, I don't know if I was in the open mic, if I could have got out, because there is that thing of privilege to play, because there's so many.
Yeah.
There is that thing of like the open, the middle, because when I was coming up, there was still the middle spot.
Yeah.
There was a 2 tens that would get, you know, get 50 quid or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I was like 19, 20, you know, 50 quid was big money back then. I was actually telling the sound guy that he was, spoke to this comedian called Ari Styler, and that was the first guy who paid me. He's giving me 25 quid. To play a shisha bar in the middle of North London, and it was the worst gig ever. But I remember getting 25 quid and thinking that I was the king. I was like ringing up my mum saying, "We've moved on up.
Yeah,
I'm getting 25 quid for these gigs."
Well, when people say to me, "How'd you get started?" I don't know, because it's like I'm talking about the Stone Age now.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, you know what you did was you did loads of open spots, and if you're any good, after about a year and a half, you'd get half spots, and then you'd work up and
was there the Tunnel Club?
Right, I missed the very end of the Tunnel Club. I did Malcolm's next gig a lot.
Okay,
yeah, up the creek. Yeah, but I mean, I always funny enough, I drove past it the weekend and I always think about it. Is that a great documentary about it?
Yeah. I haven't seen. Do you know what? I've been trying to watch it, but I can't.
It was knocking about on the internet for a bit.
I need to watch that. But that's one club always.
But I mean, I did catch the end of that sort of era. I caught the end of the era where, you know, a lot of people on the alternative circuit were from Variety, or they'd been street entertainers, and it was a sort of more sloppy and messy. But you know, there would be chaotic acts that I really miss, like the Iceman, whose act was that he would melt a block of ice and talk about it whilst doing it, and use like blow torches, but also you know, de-icer for cars, would really. You're not really supposed to use that indoors, and probably choking everything. There's a guy called Steve Murray who just used to cut teddy bears up, like execute them.
I was talking to Mark Steele, and he was telling me about all of this, and I was like, "And what would people?" Because like this, the idea now, I think, okay, say if I was in Jonglers Portsmouth and the guy came and started cutting ice, and they go, "I go, what would people do?" And you go, "They'd watch it." And you go, "That's like
a well, maybe." Although now I think there's kind of people, right? People have seen a lot of stand-up on telly. They have an idea of what they think it is, and so they have an idea that they're being short-changed in some way if they don't get that.
Whereas in that
period, people had gone to the comedy club. No one knew who anyone was anyway. Mm. No one was famous, so they just sort of
watch whatever.
And what was good about Malcolm's audience? Malcolm managed to create an atmosphere whereby the audience heckled you off, but he expected heckles to have some quality to them.
Yeah, right? It wasn't just.
And also, he did another thing really brilliantly where he would slag you off after you'd been on to get back in with the audience, but he'd do it in such a way as also flattered you. And I remember the first time I did a gig for him, which was about the end of '89, he went, "That was Stuart Lee, started off well, got worse. By the end, it was shit." Right? But he didn't mind because he got back in with them, but he kept a little bit of your dignity.
There was some salvation into that.
Yeah, but I've seen comics like trash the acts, you know, and I really hate that.
It does. You see it a lot on the gong shows.
Yeah.
You saw the gong shows and it is that sort of like gladiator-esque thing. And it's never been my style. I think that it's kind of maybe not healthy, but it's us against them.
Yeah.
Even if you're still on my side.
If there's a load of comics together complaining about people's acts, you know, or if we don't like this, I'll join in, right? But if I'm in a place where there's a member of the public criticising a comedian,
I'll jump in.
We were on holiday once, me and the wife, and like there was these people in this little cottage opposite in Cornwall, and they'd seen someone, and they'd say he wasn't any good, and I just absolutely wouldn't have it with him. he wasn't that good actually, the bloke, but he was good sometimes, you know. And they were saying they couldn't imagine that he could ever work, and I was going, "We don't know anything about it." I got in a cab, and the bloke was complaining about John Bishop, and I just thought, I've seen John Bishop do, when he started out, the most fantastic shows in a porter cabin. I'm not going to sit there and have someone, you know. So it's really weird. You're like, stick up for the community. Even people I hate.
Even hacks. For them. Even the worst comic who I think is a piece of shit. I'll be like, don't you dare talk about his act in front of me like that.
But then privately, I'd go, "Oh, I hate that."
Bro. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I think it is that, because it is that sort of thing of it is that, you know, there is a, and do you know, because I was talking about this with someone else, is about comedians, and there is a certain thing that I like about the community of comedians, that we have our own language.
Yeah.
And there is a certain thing that I do enjoy, and I remember when I first started, I found camaraderie in it. Is there is a nice feeling of not having to prerequisite everything with, you know, I'm only joking.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Do you know what I'm saying? No,
but you know what? You forget that in the real world, right? And it sometimes gets you in trouble, right? Yeah. I mean, I remember dropping my kid off at school, and there was they'd had to make a model of an island, right, for a geography project. They were all about five or six. And the one kid's model of an island was obviously the dad had done it, and he probably worked in a museum. It was so good.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the other mums went, oh, look at Johnny's map of the island. It's really good, isn't it? And I went, his dad obviously did it. It should be smashed up in front of him, and he should be given an E for it, and their parents should be kicked out of the school or something. They're going, what, really? You know, and you think, oh, no, I've got to say to them now, at some point, I've got to backtrack from it. You know, you can't be a civilian.
Assume.
Yeah, I know. You can't assume. And it is difficult because you sort of forget. You forget, and then you can cause these massive problems without realising it.
Well, I think it's that sort of, and that's, you know, kind of probably why I enjoy doing it, is because there's a sort of sense of freedom.
Yeah.
And sort of being away from the mundanity of what people have to say.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all some, like, at least some, you know, tone of it, don't matter, and it's like any idea you can joke about.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying. That's
you know, I mean, that is a thing that is more difficult now for people. Is that? I mean, I'm of a generation where I remember when there wasn't political correctness, and I like political correctness, and I don't necessarily like people throwing the baby out of the bathwater and going, "Oh, we kind of." But you know, when everything is filmed now. You know, someone might always have a camera phone. Things are reported on and tweets and whatever. It's quite difficult to work out a controversial idea on stage, right? Because you sometimes go through 20, 30 versions of a thing.
Because you can't work out the premise.
Yeah, before you work out how you can say that thing in such a way that obviously you didn't mean it and it's counterbalanced by that. And I think that little leeway's gone because everything can be reported on and written on, you know.
And so you jump on the molecule, the idea, and it's like, well, it's going somewhere,
it can
sort of be taken out of context with one word. But I do agree with you in that sort of baby with the bathwater, because there's that weird thing, you know, when I've done that show about the Nazis and and it's sort of like jumping into sort of talking about far right wing ideas.
You know what I feel good about that, to interrupt, is there is an assumption now. The world is full of liberals making stuff up and complaining about prejudices that don't exist. So it's very good to see you go around the world and meet absolutely insane people that really, really believe those crazy things.
Yeah, these crazy
and
ideologies.
And be saying them to your face.
Oh, yeah, these mental ideologies. And it's just like the casualness of it. And you know, though, the best thing is when you sort of ask someone about it
and you
could see that they know they're being crazy, but they just want to say nigger. And it's like, they will create this whole conspiracy about the Jews and all of this. And it's like, listen, you could have just said that word without wearing the swastika.
What was interesting about those is like, you know, some people would have huge swathes of historical evidence ready to discredit the argument. What you did with the white supremacists, anti-Semitic people, was ask them if they ate bagel. that began to unravel it.
Yeah,
like they'd never even thought about eating a Jewish, you know, bakery product.
You realise that they get sort of. But to take it back to political correctness, there is that weird thing in it. It's like it's sort of the ideas become so polarized, and it's sort of like you have to be at one end of the extreme or the other end of the extreme. It's sort of like it's just like, you know, say nothing, which is ridiculous, or why can't I say nigger? And it's like, what? there is a middle ground, which is the minority, the majority. You know, it's
that's partly why I don't really know what to do. I mean, I've stopped for a bit, and it's a good time to stop because, like, when I started out in comedy, which had come out. Alternative comedy came out of the left in Britain, and you know, it came out of punk and post-punk, and it came out of the left, and it came out of mung bean eating social workers running gigs in squats in East London. It came out of that, and it came out of the festival circuit, and it came out of the hippie world, and you know, and there was a liberal consensus in comedy, and so you knew where you fitted. And I think what I did a bit in the mid 90s was when the liberal consensus seemed really like the prevailing thing, you almost went against it a bit because the architecture seemed so in place. Now I don't really know I don't really know where I fit in relation to it, and it's a good time to stop for a bit. I think I'm lucky I'm old, because an old man can sort of, you know, be like this derelict figure ranting, you know. But so it's an I don't quite know where it fits. And certainly there are types of people, and there are political views on the circuit now, wrongly or rightly, that either didn't exist 30 years ago or no one would have felt comfortable expressing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that reflects society generally. You know? So it's, I don't quite know what to do next. Yeah.
In terms of you trying to formulate that idea now, and you go, okay, I need to know where I am and what I feel about these subjects, because there is that thing in it. It's like you want to go against the status quo, but it's weird we don't know what the status quo is now, where it's sort of like there is such a push off. The right is rising. There is a huge influx of the right, but then also there's this sort of, you know, sort of really strong sort of far left wing ideas happening as well. And it is that sort of thing of, where does reasonability come?
Yeah.
And where does that, and then you trying to make it comical. So how long do you think it would take before you sort of...
Well, I think I'm moving towards a thing where I'm able to put the liberal ideas across that I think, but at the same time invite you to find the idea of someone hanging on to all this funny. And in a way, partly what makes a stand-up funny, I think, is they have to be struggling. You know, they have to be... I don't really like it when they're the power figure. You know, I think you have to be sort of struggling, have something wrong with you, there has to be some problem. And I think that, in a way, it's a good time to be doing sort of putting liberal stuff across, because it's not the dominant trope. Mm. So you're in opposition, you know. And that's true about how people perform. So I saw Andy Kindler last night, an American comic, and his shtick is that the gig's going badly and he's disappointed. He isn't. It's going exactly as he wants it to.
Yeah.
And the audience, which was half comedians last night,
yeah,
really get that. But some critics have gone, oh, he doesn't seem to be enjoying himself. It's like, it's his joke. The joke is that he's struggling. I don't really like it. I don't like a sort of cocky person running the room when there's no suggestion that there's any problem with them. You know, I think there should be...
Yeah, I think it's the sort of the... I think as well, you hold so much power doing comedy, is that you're holding the mic, you're holding the room, you're holding the attention.
Yeah.
And I think there has to be some type of vulnerability to that.
I think there has to be a sort of suggestion, why are you there?
Yeah.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah, there has to be some reason why. You can't just be there for the sake of it.
Yeah. Jamal.
The specials I've seen is, like, I've seen a lot of the Go Faster Strike specials.
Oh, I did one for that, a 90s comedian, which was about... That was mainly off the back of... when I did, I co-wrote the words for an opera about the Jerry Springer American Talk Show, which was written by a composer called Richard Thomas.
Yeah. And then which you got a lot of shit for.
Yeah, there was a lot of sort of controversy about that. And that show was partly about what is offensive religious imagery and what isn't. You know?
Yeah. And so tell me about it. So when you wrote that, did you realise how much aggro you're going to get? Because this is you wrote the Jerry Springer opera.
I co-wrote the words. The basic premise of it, which is that the basic premise of it was Richard Thomas was and still is really a comedian, but he was also a composer. He was in a funny double act in the early 90s called Miles and Milner. It was like Tim Minchin sort of stuff,
Yeah.
He was really good, and he said that he was watching the Jerry Springer show on TV one night, and there were loads of fat people shouting, and you couldn't understand what they were saying, and that's the same as an opera, right? And so he went from there, and the first hour, which was mainly all him, was about the guests in the studio arguing, and it was all sung like an opera. And the second half, which was mainly me lyrically, was Springer was assassinated, and then he's sort of in hell, and the devil does a deal with him that if he can reconcile heaven and hell, he can go back to life. And then he has to reconcile heaven and hell in the form of a chat show where God's there and Jesus and the devil and Mary and whatever, and it's all so... Excellent. And that was the bit that... that was the main source of the problems, which, no, we didn't anticipate, because, context, when we wrote it, it was at Battersea Arts Centre, where Guardian reading liberals who would have understood it go, and it was being performed to 120 people. The problem was, it became popular, yeah, and it went into a space like the National Theatre and then Commercial Theatre, where it was found out about by people who, without seeing it, made a set of assumptions about what it was. And weirdly, if the internet had been up and running then, we'd probably been able to head those off, because people that had seen it would have gone, yeah, but that's not in it.
Yeah, or whatever. Yeah.
But it got to the point where, you know, I did about 5 years' work on it, and it with commercial theatre, there's a break-even point down the line, and you're always told when it's on everywhere, you'll reach that break-even point and you'll get paid. And because it was sued and banned and whatever, this break-even point, you know, never came. And it was a very difficult 5 years. And it was also difficult because I got, you know, I got Olivier Awards for it and things like that, and I never really saw anything from it. So I got investigated by the Inland Revenue, who kind of came round and went,
"You're hiding it.
You've got a West End theatre run. You've got this awards cabinet.
Yeah.
Why has you got no money?" Then they gave me a rebate. So it was
worked out then.
Yeah, it was a weird period. But that was that after that, that's when I really thought, the thing about stand up is you can say what you want, you can control who you're doing it to, you don't need financial backing, and if I do 100 people in a pub and get a quarter of the door, I'm making more in one night than I am out of
doing
a month of this thing on in the West End, you know.
That is you know, the fact that it got, especially in England. I mean, and this was 10 years ago, maybe now.
15 years ago. Yeah.
So it's not even like what it is now in terms of, you know, I know there's sort of like a more religious controversy,
yeah,
you know, with the thing that happened in Paris and
Well, it'd be more difficult.
Charlie Hebdo
now,
and
right,
stuff, and you know, because that there has been sort of that. Yeah. But it's just like, you know, because we have you know, we have Darwin on the £10 note. Like, we're not a country that I think would sort of react in that way.
Well,
it
would be more complicated now, right? Because at the time in Britain, debates about religious influence mainly concerned branches of the Christian religion controlling schools or whatever, and then obviously the rise of extreme Islam has massively complicated that, as has the level of threat which religious people are prepared to deploy. You know, they'll go beyond writing a stiff letter.
They'll write into the manager, write into the BBC. You know, that would have the complaint show.
It's much more complicated now, and it seems like and it's also much more complicated now because of social media and things like that. You know, stuff would just mushroom up much more quickly. But so, you know. Yeah, he tried to get it going again in New York, actually, Richard Thomas, and I think it's sort of in the balance there. But weirdly, I thought it would seem like from a long time ago, but actually he said it sort of prefigures the rise of Trump, basically a celebrity, TV character becoming this sort of, political figure. Yeah.
It's a crazy time. Especially, I mean, it is weird how things you make sort of resonate at a later date, you know. And not to bring it back to, you know, I always feel fucking shitty talking about my show.
Right, yeah.
It's always like a shitty moment bringing up my show. But it's like, I remember when I made that show, the first episode in Sweden, they were telling me about, they were like, we're alt-right. And I remember we didn't even know what it meant.
Yeah.
That's how weird it was. Like, I didn't even know what that meant, alt-right. I was like, what's alt-right? And it was like, and then it was sort of, Trump wasn't even, people were laughing at Trump at that time.
Yeah.
And then when I sort of went to America, then Trump had got in the race.
Yeah.
And then it was all the Nazis had the Trump stickers. And it was just like a weird time to see that rise and sort of being with the far right.
Sweden's in the balance now. I mean, Andrew Kindler had a funny bit last night, actually, about the outright, about it being sort of fascism for hipsters. You know, it's really funny. Like, but yeah, I mean, who saw that coming? And I think there's a lot of that sort of sensibility in some stand-ups now, that outright sensibility. And I don't know... what you do about that, really?
It's that hard thing. I think it's kind of the market does dictate what people do.
Yeah.
And I don't. Again, it's that weird thing, isn't it? Like, I don't know how many comedians are actually out there doing that. I think it's sort of they feel that this sort of lefty idea of comedy is the status quo, and they're just doing things to go against it.
Well, actually, I know what you mean.
That's punk now. Like, well, you know what? Maybe I don't like refugees, and you go, okay, but it's not.
Well, no, it's for the last few years, every summer in Edinburgh, the Daily Telegraph's tried to make a feature about the here come the new right wing comics. Yeah. They only ever managed to find two really. They're really good. And then this year they didn't bother.
And it was like, and even the ones that are the right wing comics, they're not that, even their act isn't right wing. It's just they vote Tory and that's about, they just want to pay a bit less tax. The act isn't actually that right wing.
Yeah.
You know, it's only that one or two comics that, especially trying to sell. In Edinburgh, I saw a guy with a fucking Trump hat and an Alex Jones t-shirt.
Oh, right.
And I was just like, he's like just walking around the streets. Yeah. And I was like, this is like in Edinburgh.
Actually, there's a thing in one of the broadsheets complaining that a lot of the shows in Edinburgh seem to be anti-Brexit, or certainly the performers were in the Fringe. And I thought, God, that's so weird cause, to complain about that, because one of the reasons the Fringe was set up after the war was in a spirit of international European cooperation. It was specifically about trying to rebuild European bridges off the wall. So actually, it's sort of in the DNA of it that it's an international event. So it wouldn't be, you know.
What do you feel about sort of this idea of, you know, like, oh, it's, you know, like comedians going up being like anti-Trump, anti-Brexit? Do you think it is sort of overdone, or do you think that's just the zeitgeist of just how they feel?
Do you mean in Edinburgh?
Yeah, because walking through the streets, you do sort of.
Yeah, but
like,
Edinburgh's the thing about the Fringe is that a lot of people don't understand is no one has to ask anyone if they can go, right? No one gets approved, right? A woman was telling me, 2 years ago, that the Fringe was obviously blocking people that were pro the Scottish and English Union, and that they were deliberately putting on loads of anti-English comedians doing Scottish nationalist shows. And I went, they aren't, because there's no governing body that decides on content. Yeah. And she wouldn't have it. She was convinced that this. So if there's loads of people doing anti-Trump and Brexit material, that's because they've paid for a room and gone there. It's not that there's some organisational body doing it. You know, and they're right are weird about this, because they like to say the market decides, right? And that ultimately that's what it's about. The market decides. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, when the UKIP conference had an old school like racist working men's club comic on, doing anti-Islamic stuff and whatever. At the time, Paul Nuttall, who was leading UKIP then, had said that Johnny and the Baptists, you know them, should be banned from any theatres that received any public subsidy if
I
they did
that,
anti
a UKIP song.
UKIP
yeah.
song, right? But what Farage said, he's obviously cleverer than Paul Nuttall's. He said at the same time this other thing was kicking off, and he said that that the market would decide, and you shouldn't ban a comedian for doing racist stuff, because ultimately the market was the arbiter of taste. So he took a different position. Mm. Weirdly, you know, Nuttall seemed to think there should be some intervention over and above the market, whereas Farage said that it can only be the market. So they can't kind of have it both ways. No. The market will sustain a festival in which the comedy content is 80% liberal, you can't then say you need to fabricate balance in a free market. You might have to do it for a broadcaster, but not for a free market.
Because there is hypocrisy that I see in terms of, it's like, oh, I want freedom of speech. And it's like, well, you can have it, but it's like they think that it comes with no consequence. Yeah. So it's like that idea, like the same what you were just saying, it's sort of the market dictates. And it's like, well, the market says that they want your show. It's like, oh, they take away my freedom of speech. It's like, no, but it's the thing you just exactly said. It's just not in line with what you're selling.
Yeah.
You know? You see, when you made the... One question I do want to ask you is just... it's going to be a gear shift here. When you made the Alternative Comedy Experience, which is a great show, and it's actually one of those... And you know what? Like, as a comedian, that was the one stand-up show that I always wanted to do. Like, I'm watching that, and I'd be like, if I ever... Nah, that's cool. If I ever do... Now, there's only a few things in comedy I ever wanted to do, and it was play the Comedy Caf.
Yeah.
Because I used to, when I was like open mic, and I used to walk past it all the time. And that was the first club that put me on weekends. Faulkner, that crazy bastard.
I remember him opening that, you know, in about 89, 90.
Yeah,
it was
shut now, isn't it?
But no one used to go out around there. We thought, what are you doing opening this?
He's a character in himself. Yeah. Old Norfolk, he was the first one. And it was to do the Alternative Comedy Experience and to play Amsterdam Tumbler. My three things I wanted to do. And I'd done two of those things, but I never got to do the Alternative. But why did you pick the Stand Comedy Club?
Well, because I thought that it would look really good on camera.
It did.
Yeah, I thought that... the sorts of acts I wanted might have played there, so they'd feel comfortable in that place. I didn't really want it to be in London, so that
it was like the Edinburgh Stand, right?
Yeah, Edinburgh Stand. Yeah, and I thought that the Stand had a little bit of kudos. It brought a little bit of kudos to it in terms of sort of it's not one of the big four venues in Edinburgh. It's just a little bit sort of left field in its own way. I thought people might trust it a bit more of, you know, comics going on there. And I thought it would, mainly thought it would look really good. And it looks like a comedy club. It doesn't look like a TV studio, you know. It's quite easy to light as well because it's small, you know. And also I wanted people to be, I've got a thing I'm obsessed with in how you film stand-up, right, which is that I don't like the false rhythm of cuts, like where you go to audience responses. And particularly transparent on things like Live at the Apollo, which has got loads of strengths and it gives me a really long spot, but they do choose very specific audience reaction shots to try and change the way the audience at home are receiving the material. They want to reassure you that it's okay.
Yeah, so if you do a joke about a black person, they'll cut the black person.
And so what I try and do is get camera positions that, and I work this out when I got asked to direct a thing for Johnny Vegas about 15 years ago, which I mainly balls that really badly, but I did shoot the stand-up well, which is I wanted to shoot across the acts so that you see an audience response in real time. Right? There's not a breaking of the rhythm to the thing, and I've always done that. I've done it all through Comedy Vehicle. There are no breaks for reaction shots. So the other thing about the stand, you've got people on three sides, and you could mainly you could see that the gig was actually working or not. But because what these people do, on they write into papers, I get it. Well, you do a thing live. That the last telly special, there were no dub laughs on it. In fact, I took some out because one bit that I wanted to fail went too well, right? That's, but you've still got people going, where do they get this canned laughter from? No one would laugh at this. Well, they fucking did, So that's partly why you shot it.
Because I remember, because when I had done my one, you was like the how you filled the Comedy Vehicle was like the template of, in terms of like what influenced my one, where I was like, I don't want shitty audience shots. Every time they would pan it to the audience, I would like jump in front of the camera to block the shot.
I think it causes a lack of trust somehow. I think you have to remove the opportunity for them to complain about it.
You know? Do you direct your own specials? Or do you edit your own specials?
I talk, but I work really closely with the people. For Comedy Vehicle, and most of the specials have been directed by Tim Kirkby, and we sort of worked out a grammar for it.
I remember one of my favourite bits is it was a sketch, and it was about it was a, sort of taking like the sort of piss out of like the sort of old American comedies, and it's like fag rats.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That was
you know what that came from? No. Right? Well, in 94, me and Kevin Eldon and Ben Moore, who's a sort of performance artist, we went as young men, like travelling around America for a month, right? And we stayed with Harmon Leon in San Francisco, who's a great American stand-up, still does the Free Fringe every year. And he we used to meet all these San Francisco stand-ups every night, and there was one guy, and I don't even know what his name was, right? But he kept going on about how he'd got some people coming to see a showcase that he was doing next week, and every night he'd be really stressing out with the other comedians. We're going, should I do my mouse bit? And then someone going, don't do the mouse bit. And they're going, do that mouse bit, man, it kills. And we never saw the mouse bit or knew what it was, right? So for the rest of the month when we were traveling around America, we used to sort of improvise the mouse bit to each other in the styles of different American stand-ups. And there was a sort of thing at the time of like shock, you know.
Yeah, that sort of like the Bill Hicksley type of like wearing a turtleneck, smoking a cigarette.
So that fag rats thing, it might even have been Kevin's, to be honest. I don't know. But it was sort of in my, it'd been in my mind for about 20 years, you know, this the fag rats thing from, I remember we used to sort of improvise these American hate comic routines, but they'd be directed against animals and stuff.
Yeah, that is
rather than people,
funny.
So that's where it came from. But Tony Law did that.
Yeah, he killed it. Really, it was just well, like, it's just that fag rat. And I remember watching that. I remember when I was me and my mate Henry, that's like one of the jokes that we always quote.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of those things where actually, obviously that thing, I ended up writing it, but it's one of those things where, which you sometimes get with comedy, where the authorship of an idea sometimes comes out of a lot of people having fun, doesn't it? And then you have this slightly awkward thing where it's, how has it developed, you know? Because that was very, I mean, my wife, whenever she meets someone I was at school with, she goes, oh, you've got this sort of sense of humour that obviously was your group of friends. And I'm just profiteered from it whilst they
they got real jobs. Agents, you know? They got real jobs while you're living the dream. They're just taking little bits of their essence.
It was a sort of just horrible, sarcastic sort of thing that a little.
Did you ever work America?
I did the Montreal Festival in Canada in mm-hmm. about 96 and 97, and then I did it again. I did that and Aspen around 2005.
Oh, in Colorado?
Yeah.
Was that a good festival?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't really like most American stand-ups. And I think it's because we're spoilt here. Because you see the British acts, the Irish acts, and the visiting Australian
museum.
That's
interesting because I mean, it's sort of like American stand-up, especially because they even like, because I think as well, it was like in England. I mean, this is like from this is like the consensus for my generation.
Yeah.
Right? In England, there is a sort of like the Edinburgh Hour.
The
Edinburgh Hour, where it's sort of like through line idea, bang, and all that. And then now there is a sort of thing of a lot of comedians look up to the American Hour, where it's just hour jokes.
Yeah.
And people want to see more than line. Well, so it's interesting that you sort of say that, like, you know, I know you're obviously not saying that you think all American comics are shit.
There's some great brilliant. Ones. Yeah.
They've got some of the best in the
world. Well, I don't think it's even that they're better or worse. I think what it is the Edinburgh Hour. Okay, so sociologically, right, after the war, you know, there was lots of funding in arts centres and things like that. So all around the country, there are these 100, 150 seat venues. In the 80s, the funding was cut by Thatcher. So there were a lot of rooms going spare that needed to be filled. Yeah. The alternative comedy boom created tourable little shows of low economic impact. And so there was an impetus because of the fringe and these little venues to create these sort of hours. In America, there was never that. A club headliner does 40 minutes. The bottom of the bill guys might be doing a tight, well, you go to an American club, they ask you to do 7 minutes.
It's tight, right? and it's not eight.
It's, no,
no, seven, it's seven.
So so actually the system there didn't force them to make better shows. It made them make tiny marketable chunks,
and the hour they do has to be like that because it's a club.
Yeah, because it's a club,
not.
Yeah.
It's not like people coming to a festival and having to sit there. Yeah.
I'm not patriotic about many things. One thing I'm patriotic about is stand up here. You know, and I think
it's great.
Yeah. I think it's great, and I think what's happened. Like, there's articles now floating around in American media about this new kind of comedy.
And this is Edinburgh.
It's Edinburgh. It's Americans that have been to Edinburgh.
Yeah,
like. You know, Harry Condero, Reggie Watts,
loads
of people, and they've gone back, and they've tried to do that, and then I read these articles, then I'm a sort of footnote at the bottom of like, there are some British comedians that do that. We fucking invented
that. Yeah.
You know, you know, it's like it's really weird.
Was it Sean Hughes that invented that, do you think?
Huh?
Was it Sean Hughes that invented that?
Well,
the first one
was that. And
because he's still the youngest ever that won it, right? He won it like 21 or something.
Yeah, I mean, he did, you know, it was a big deal. But then he didn't really do that again. He sort of became a quiz show guy and, you know, it was sad really.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
But yeah, that show was like that. And then there's an Australian guy called Greg Fleet who saw that show and pretty quickly he was the guy doing that in Australia, but he won't mind me saying he had a heroin addiction problem, which, you know, served to slow his progress in many ways.
Heroin does that. There was something about heroin that doesn't make you speed up. You know, it's like the sound that you really want to sit down on the couch and smoke a cigarette instead of writing some bits.
I mean, it must be really great.
Yeah, oh, mate, heroin must be amazing.
It certainly doesn't seem to have any other beneficial.
Because that's sometimes I see a crackhead and I'll be like, you've lost your wife, your family, your kids, and you're still like, you want to get some more rock? That must be delicious. It must be so good. You've lost everything. You'd be like, let's get some more.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that when I saw Americans in Aspen and Montreal, I was thinking, what? You know, it's just like nothing, you know. But then obviously there are really good people, but I think they're being made to stretch a bit now. That weirdly, you know, Hannah Gadsby going over there, that's a very extreme form of the of the written show, probably arguably a logical endpoint of it, actually. And but it certainly put the cat amongst the pigeons over there.
You know, it did definitely separate what was the norm out there in terms of shifting it.
Jamal,
you see, when you done the comedy vehicle, what was sort of the idea of what you wanted to get out of the show? And I know that's a weird question, and I'm super nerding out here.
Well,
but it's the idea of sort of like, and this is just from my perspective, is you're doing like a solid hour of comedy, and it's like a special, but then it's sort of through-lined,
initially wanted, I don't think it really hit its stride to about the second. And then the third series. I think the third series was one where it like worked the best. And I was lucky, I think, in retrospect, to get it recommissioned. In between the first and second series. First of all, I wanted it to be a true portrayal of what stand-up was like. So that's why I tried to film it in a small place where there was the chance things wouldn't work and where it would be exposed. Initially, I wanted to film it in places where I actively wasn't wanted. I wanted to do the gigs on cruise ships or, you know.
That is hilarious.
But they wouldn't go for that because I would have gone down badly. Then I wanted to cut it in with the same material going well in a theatre.
Yeah.
I thought that'd be really interesting because members of the public like to think you're either good or bad.
Yeah,
right? They can't separate out environmental factors from a stand-up working.
Yeah,
I thought it'd be really cool to cut in mid-sentence to something dying and then working.
That is genius. That'd be great.
Yeah, but they wouldn't go for that. And that initial version of it just was knocked back for about two years. So really it was to do it in a place where it felt like the thing. I didn't really want to do the sketches in it. I wanted to maybe do one at the end. But there was a nervousness about doing a straight half hour of stand-up. I don't know. There just was. It hadn't really been done before, you know. And so in the first series, I used lots of different 5 or 6 minute routines that I had and sort of tried to group them together. After the first series, for each series, I wrote 6 half hours specifically that had a through line that would work for that. That's why it started to come together better. And I wanted to know the stuff so well that I could improvise in the room and chuck it out if I wanted to. And actually, there's stuff that never made it to the screen that was written for it because something happened in the room that I felt I should go with, and that's a, you know, I think that might be in Franklin Ajay, a black American stand-up writer, sort of book about the rules of stand-up. It's quite funny, it's an interesting book. And I think that's he's very good, really. He sort of says, you know, you've got to follow what happens in the room, and the jazz guys say that as well. You've got to, if something happens, you've got to follow that. You can't stick to, you know, so that it was to give you enough space to do that. But I think the third series is where it really came together. In the fourth one, I was doing really extreme things that were working on tour because by that time I was doing 1,000, 2,000 seater rooms.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a numbers game, isn't it? If you've got a weird bit that 10% of a room like, in a room of 50 people, that 5 never reach a tipping point. But in a room of 1,000, 2,000 people, it's 200 people and everyone else goes, oh, it must be funny. And they start joining in with them. And then I crunched this stuff down from doing it in 2,000 seater rooms to back filming it in front of 100 people for the telly series. And stuff that had built and like really gone off seemed like willfully odd in the fourth series, but actually it worked for 6 months around the country, you know.
You're the master at sort of the breaking of the fourth wall when you look into the camera and speak directly down the lens.
Well, I don't know. That's very kind of you. I don't know where, but I think that came from trying to think. This is a live show, right, in a room, but how do you make it feel like television as well?
Yeah.
And one of the things was to sort of make the audience at home your kind of conspirators or your enemy.
To refer
to them via the people in the room and go, oh, these people at home, man, what's going on? They've gone out. They've gone to for a piss now.
Because playing two levels, because you've got to play the room, I think there is that thing. It's like, because I've done, I mean, when I did the Apollo once. And Anthony, the guy who books it, he's like, play down the barrel. He goes, I was nervous. He goes, just play down the barrel.
Yeah.
And it is that weird thing of, just as a comic, I want the room to like,
yeah.
It's not even the people watching me at home. Yeah. So is that natural thing of, you want the bits to go well
there.
You
can do it. The funny thing about that was in the first series and second series, I used to say that I didn't like the people at home because they wouldn't be like it. And then by the fourth series, I was slagging off the people at home because saying they were like sycophants trying to be clever, liking the front stuff. So it's sort of, you change who they are.
You see, like now you're doing the 2,000 seaters and stuff. What do you prefer? Do you prefer the sport? Because I know like you was doing like the Leicester Square and then you sort of doing like the stands and that, and you sort of built, because it's, you know, it's been a build.
To me, the perfect room is Leicester Square Theatre, and you know, some of, because it feels like a club and a theatre at the same time. But it's 500 people. To meet the demand for tickets last time I toured, and I still didn't do it. I ended up doing 6 months of like five nights a week at Leicester Square and a week at the Royal Festival Hall. Now, if you were to break that down into O2s, it would be like 16 O2s or 6 weeks at Hammersmith Apollo or something like that.
Yeah.
But that wouldn't suit me, because the perception of me is that I'm not a success, right? The weird thing, that the knock-on effect that has in real terms is a broadcaster like Netflix doesn't think I'm a success because I don't do Hammersmith Apollo, you know, but actually the numbers are much higher. Also, you can keep the cost down in smaller places because you don't have overheads of getting all this kit
and the rental and stuff.
So, and I think that works better for my audience.
Would you ever do like the O2?
You know what? I don't know what to do next time. I think it might be fun. I did have this idea about how could you do a stadium-sized show that destroyed the conventions of the stadium.
Because it had no screens.
You could have a screen with different stuff on
it. That would be fucking funny.
Like, could you... Well, you know what I'm not going to say, because I've got half a plan about this, and I've been talking to some computer.
Because that would be hilarious. Yeah. Like I always, because someone had mentioned before that, like if you did break down the numbers of how many tickets you sold in Leicester Square, it was sort of a O2 size venue. Like it was, so you like, because I remember you done that. I remember because I used to play the 99 and I walked past, and it was always
and you were
there for like six, it was like a long time, and I was like,
but actually it worked out well as a dad, because you could put the kids to bed and do that homework, you know, and also there's no substitute for the fact that the more you do a show, you know, a lot of my stuff is about knowing the stuff and then trying to mess around with it. So once you've got it in, you can then take it apart or move it around, or you know it well enough to pull a bit out and think, I'll chuck it in there later on. You know, so, and I really have to know. Also, I don't know what it is, but I can't really learn stuff like I used to. So I have to get a feel for it by doing it live. I can't learn 6,000 words of a 2-hour show and just do it. I can't, you know, I have to break it in now. So.
Is it one question I did want to, because it's like, it's going to sound strange, but there's a point of why I'm asking it. Is, you see, like being at Oxford, you went to Oxford, right?
Yeah, I was.
What was it like going to Oxford? It's just because that's like a world that's totally just for me. I don't know anyone that's been to Oxford.
It's an interesting thing that I ended up there, and I went to a private school. I went to a private school because I got a part scholarship, and because I was a single parent family, because I was adopted, I got this charity grant for orphans, waifs and strays, which meant that, so I ended up first of all in a school that I socially shouldn't have been at, right? So it's interesting. That was interesting. And then
why do you mean socially shouldn't have been there, sir?
Because I didn't have any money. I didn't have the money that people that paid the fees had, you know. So
was that made clear to you by the other students?
No one really. It was only years later sometimes I went into people and they go, why were you at that school? I saw where you lived. How did you, you know? So it was sort of fun. So that was interesting, and I really enjoyed being at that school. Then I passed in those days you could do an exam in a special, in your special subject for Oxford, and I did English, which I was good at, and you get in, right? There was about half of the 10 people on my English course in my college would conform to the stereotype that you'd said, and the other half were from all different sorts of backgrounds. I think students were from more different backgrounds then there because you got full grants and, you know, it's more difficult now. When I look back, when I go there now to do things, I cannot believe that I was allowed to go there. It seems absolutely off the scale, insane, that you spent 3 years studying English with like people that had written books about it in these medieval buildings, you know. It seems absolutely unbelievable. But at the same time, in the town, there was a functioning town with normal music gigs and normal comedy gigs, and do you know what I mean? Yeah, so it wasn't completely... One of the reasons I wanted to go there was because I had a Saturday job in a doctor's filing. And one of the doctors, who was called Mark Payne, had been a student in Oxford in the 70s and had written for student reviews with people like Mel Smith that went on to be Not 9 o'clock News and stuff like that. Yeah. And he said that there was the Fringe. There were comedy clubs run by students in the town where they worked out shows, and then they used to be able to go to Edinburgh Fringe. And I thought, I'd like to do that. The weird thing about doing it at that exact point in time was with entire understandable justification, comedy had completely turned in the 80s against the idea of Oxford students doing shows. Yeah. There was, because it was seen like an entrenched privilege, and a and alternative comedy was about giving other people a go, which as it turned out was mainly students from Manchester University. Mainly white students
from
Manchester University who had middle class parents. So actually, weirdly, starting the circuit in 89, there was a problem if people found out you'd gone there rather than the other way around. And in fact, when I won Hackney Empire, New Act of the Year in 1990, the head of the judges was a bloke called John Connor, who wrote for City Limits.
That's a year before I was born.
Yeah, right. And anyway, he gave me the award on stage, and as we were walking backstage, he went, "Oh, it's great to have someone normal like you, you know, doing so well in comedy. We'll show Oxford like Rob Newman and David Baddiel." And I went, "Oh, I went to Oxford." And he went, "Oh God, you didn't, did you?" And I went, "Yeah." And he went, "Well, you're not like them, are you?" And I went, "Well, I don't know. I don't know them, you know." And then I was supposed to get a booking at the Comedy Store and to go on Saturday Live, which was the live at the Apollo of 1990. Yeah, yeah. And both those disappeared. And I don't know if it was because John Connor thought, "Oh no, what have I done? I've like got another one of these traitors into the..."
So you never got your spot at the Store or the...
No, I never got to play the Store. And I carried on doing open spots there, but I was never given the paid spot I was supposed to get for winning. And after I did about five open spots there, and they used to go all right. And then I kept saying to the guy that ran it, who was called Kim Kinney, who died recently, I kept saying, "Can I have a spot?" And then, because it would go all right, you know. Yeah. And they went, "Come and see me." And I went to see him in about June 1990. And he told me to come at 6 o'clock or something. And I went at 6 o'clock. And he said, "Just wait." And I waited for about 20 minutes. Well, he ate a salad, not even warm food. He ate a salad in silence whilst drinking a glass of wine, right? And then when he finished it and dabbed down his lips, right? Which is, can only be about status, can't it? Because it was a salad. It wasn't like it was going to go cold, right? He said to me, "Yes, well, I've seen you." He said, "I would book you, but you remind me of the comedian that I think is the worst in the world." And I said, "Who's that?" And he went, "Simon Munnery." And I went, "Well, I think he's brilliant."
That's
and
great.
I know. In 1990, as far as I was concerned, and I still think it... Munnery's was a genius. Well, he literally is a genius. You know, he got highest A-level results in Britain in 1985. No, yeah.
Fucking really?
Yeah.
Damn.
He's literally the cleverest 51-year-old person in Britain, right? And Kim Kinney had said, who ran the Comedy Store, said, "This is the opposite of what stand-up should be." And, of course, it was exactly what I... thought it should be. I thought it was fantastic what he was doing. So I kind of thought at that point, right, so this is not the pathway for me to be doing the Store and Jonglers.
And the Store was the place.
Yeah, but weirdly, what that sort of does to you is it's really brilliant. It's like being given the keys to the kingdom, because you can, instead of thinking, "I've got to try and do that place," the bloke has told you that a salad is more important than you. That he hates you. Not does he hate you. He hates the person you think is the best comedian in the world at that point, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, this is irrelevant to me. So then it meant that I just did everything else and tried to make all that work. So it kind of removed the thing. And I think one of the things is about you know, I don't. I did a few panel shows about 15 years ago. I was getting married, and I.
What panel show did you do?
I did. Have I Got News for You once? I did Mock the Week.
That's like you don't mock the.
No, I did Cats one.
Oh, you done Cats?
And I did Buzzcocks. 8 out of 10 Cats was just terrible. I got there, and I didn't understand that they all use writers. Mm. Like, I didn't know that. I don't really, and I couldn't really understand what was going on all day when everyone was like off with these people.
Mm.
Then I went in this room and these blokes were all talking about what sort of things you might like to say.
Mm.
I didn't even really understand that I was supposed to say those things.
Bits,
so
like you didn't have to do bits.
Yeah. Then I kind of went out.
You thought you were playing an actual game show. Yeah.
And then as it started, about 30 seconds in, I went, oh, right, I see. And it's really funny if you watch it because I'm just sort of there, right? And then I... So anyway, I didn't do any of them again.
Yeah.
But then I realised there's no point trying to do those.
How was them Buzzcocks?
Well, you know what was sad about Buzzcocks, right?
Is was it with Mark Lamar was hosting?
No, it was Simon Amstel. And on the other team was Bill Oddie from The Goodies.
Okay.
Right. Now, Bill Oddie is a bit of a... He's a comedy hero of mine from childhood, you know. And but he's a bit manic, you know, and he's had his problems. But on the night, he was hilarious, right? And he was really sabotaged the game. And he did all these mad, long, improvised things off his head.
Yeah.
And everyone was really laughing, right? And at the end, I said, the only way this is going to... I said to camera, you know, on the camera, the only way this is going to work is if you sort of chop Bill's bits up because they're too long. You have to chop them in tiny bits and then play, like, film music in between them or something. I can't remember what I said. But anyway, I don't know if they used that, but they ended up doing that. They pulled all his bits out and they... chopped them together in slow motion, and it made him look as if he was mad,
yeah,
and that he'd ruined the night, yeah, right? But and that was, and what they did in the edit was they pulled out all the bits when he was owning everyone else.
Yeah.
They pulled them out because he was in the chair where the loony sits. You know, there's a chair,
yeah,
which would be some old mad woman from a band or
yeah,
some Tory or something, and he'd been put in the chair of the person who's to be made fun,
yeah,
of. But instead, he ran the room, so it was really, really unfair. And I also thought, God. An edit is the most dishonest construct, you know, yeah, for those things. So
there's nothing I hate more or fear most in this business than the edit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's what's the one thing that's giving me the most grievance and potentially blackballing me.
Yeah.
Is the edit. Like, well, I find the edit the most, like, you know, and it's that, you know, it's even like recently I'm trying to just do the live stuff. Am I just like, well, what, you know, you get an opportunity. I said, I just don't want to be edited. Like, this, the idea of getting edited keeps me up.
Well, I mean, you just have to get to a point where you can say, I need a say in the edit.
Yeah.
You know? And weirdly, the problem is, how do you get to that without doing telly? Because doing telly gives you power. I mean, as you know, every time someone appears on one of these shows, their rate goes up, right? So if you're prepared to go on loads of these things, let's take the worst possible view of it, for argument's sake.
Mm.
Let's suppose you have no self-respect, no integrity, and you don't care what happens to your work, so you're prepared to go on loads of chat shows and panel shows. Mm-hmm. That's that for a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is every time you do that, you're rewarded for your compromise financially, and your rate goes up. Then you might have the power at the back end of it to be able to say, you can't edit my stuff. Mm. What they ought to do is the opposite. The first time you go on a panel show, you could get 10 grand, and the rate should go down every time you appear until there's no incentive to do it whatsoever, right? But, you know, that's the only way it makes sense, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Because otherwise you're rewarded for, like, thinking, I won't do my own thing, I'll fit in with this. So you end up with this, like, just world of compromised people.
My idea of you and your work, and just, you know, never meeting you, but, you know, it's sort of knowing of you, is sort of like, not a lack of compromise, but a moral standing, is what I think. And that's sort of like the idea of you. I don't know if you know that.
But you know
that.
What, right? Some of that stuff.
But you do know that's the idea of you, right? Is that you have
it's the idea that the person on stage thinks that, right?
Yeah.
Partly, it's because I can't do those things, right? I would be no good on those panel shows. I haven't got loads of one-liners, and I can't learn the things the writers have written.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember where you're supposed to say them.
You could do the Apollo.
Well, I've not been asked.
No, you haven't.
No, so...
Would you do it if you was asked? Because it's a weird one, because I that's why I like to ask you, because I generally, like, I mean, talking to your, you know, yeah, you know, you obviously it is a character on stage. I'm not,
to an extent, it's based on me.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not so ignorant as, like,
it's the same.
You're not like the person on stage, it's the same. But you know, I do wonder if you know, just I would be curious though, would you do it if they
offered it? I don't know. The problem is, that the audience would not know who I was, right? Not honestly, they wouldn't. But John Bishop put me on at one of these cancer things at the Royal Albert Hall, and it was all the sorts of people on those programs, right? And then I came out, and the audience didn't know who I was at all. None of them, right? And for some reason, the screen that shows everyone, it was turned off when I came on, right? It shown like Sean Walsh and all these people from then, and Alan Carr and whatever. And then I came out and it was turned off and I went, oh, that's been turned off. Oh, that's absolutely exactly what they would do to me. So I sort of went with that. And the audience don't know. And I said, who's this bloke? Like, why is he so angry about it? But if they'd known me, they'd have thought,
yeah.
I thought it was funny, right?
Yeah, because it was like, hilarious.
That's what would happen to Stuart Lee, isn't it? The screen would be turned off, right? Yeah. But they thought I was like some petulant person they'd never heard of.
It's arrogant, like, why'd you deserve the screen?
Yeah, I know, why'd you deserve it? So it's weird. They wouldn't. So it would be difficult to do what I do at Live at the Apollo because the audience wouldn't know you were, right? Mm. So the other thing is I'd want to control the edit. I don't know if they do that. Mm. I wouldn't want cutaways to... If I did a joke about homosexuals, I wouldn't want a cutaway to some homosexuals.
Guy wearing leather.
Well, unless I was specifically dressed up like they'd just come from the Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing is that the stuff I write now, I write it to become part of big shows. Mm. So it's quite hard to prove it out. The weird thing about that is, actually, I need to ask you now, I've met you to do loads of benefits, is that because I end up organising a lot of benefits, but I still always do my 1989 open spot, basically, from 30 years ago, because that's the only bit that's a workable 10, really.
Wow.
You know.
Wait, would you do the clubs? Like a nice club?
Well,
because there was I know you do the long form stuff. And
this
that.
Is another thing that is like, I really regret it, and I'm amazed that it's happened. But what I used to do before the long tours or before Comedy Vehicle was I would do, you know, before the new Edinburgh show, I'd do March, April, May, June. I'd do clubs two or three nights a week. Mm. But what started to happen last time I tried doing that was it wasn't hugely useful because me being in a place created a level of expectation that unbalanced the evening in some way. And other acts would complain to me that people had only come to see me, so they would go badly. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but they would say that, or it would certainly make them feel like that was the case. So I felt I couldn't really do it anymore. It was like, and that was partly being in Edinburgh 2 years ago, I felt like my presence in places created problems which I would never have anticipated or believed were real, which was that, you know, you'd be walking past some free fringe venue, 7 o'clock, you're not due anywhere till 8:30. You think, oh, I can't see that person, I don't know who they are. Mm. I love doing things like that. But you go in the room, there's 10 people there. Suddenly everyone, half of them recognise you. The other half don't know who the fuck you are. Mm-hmm. So they're going, it's that bloke. Who? Him? Yeah. I don't know who he is. Then they're on there uploading it to the internet that you're there.
Yeah.
It creates a problem. Yeah. You've been there. You can't... I didn't ever think it would be me that couldn't be in a room because me being in the room ruins the gig.
You do... Right? Do you like... how does it... I mean, it sounds like I'm blowing smoke up your arse, but it's just facts of the matter. That when I say, like, when I was open micing, your name was a shorthand of in terms of people would copy.
Right. Well, I didn't. I wasn't really aware of.
But you're aware of that you are aware of that.
Aware of it now.
Because people are like, oh, he's because there was a whole generation of comedians.
Yeah. I'm aware of it mainly. I read reviews of other people and it says another Stuart Lee copyist or whatever. And I don't, you know, I'm aware of it now a bit, but also,
Is it more surreal on a level of, and I know, and I'm not trying to put you in a position here. I mean, if you know, we can stop talking about it if you want to, but is it sort of like a, you know, I know it's an awkward.
You're harder on me than you are on those white supremacists.
we've got a couple. I can understand their ideals, but you're Stuart, mate. I've really got to break it down. Right. But no, because I'm not asking you on a sort of thing of like, how does it feel to be Mr. Billy Big Bollocks? I'm asking you in the terms of how does it sort of feel that's sort of what you've created in terms of, because I know it's like the surrealness, because I think that's kind of what I battle with is surrealness of it. Like I get like someone will come up to me and ask for a photo. That is surreal as hell.
Well, the thing with me is it's not all pervasive, right? So this is a typical thing that will happen. You might be in a pub and someone will come over and go, can I have a photo? And you go, really? And they go, yeah. And I go, the thing is, it causes all sorts of problems. And you should. Then they might do it anyway.
Mm.
Then other people come over and go, should I know who you are? Because fucking don't, right?
Yeah.
Like you've done that. So most people don't know who I am. This is a classic thing that I see. In the summer holidays, I took the kids to Avebury, the Stone Circle, to look at the historic Stone Circle. And all the time, we were aware of a couple about 100 yards ahead of us walking around it. One of them's recognised me and the other doesn't know who I am. And then he's getting his phone out and trying to show. Then they're having an argument about, he's going, you know, no, I don't. That happens all the time. My own family... Right, most of the people like me are comedy fans, right? Yeah. So when your family come to see you, unless they go and see a lot of stand-up or have ever seen any before, which most people haven't, they might assume that it's not working, that you can't do it, that you've lost control, that you've got upset, that they tend to not... And then they talk to you about how great, really, just people that no one thinks are great are, that they've seen. They think they're much better than you because they went on an office party to see them and everyone enjoyed it. It wasn't like me where everyone was confused and suffered. You know, it was... So from... I don't get it from anywhere else, you know. Yeah. And also, you're, on the one hand, you're saying, oh, you're this, you're that. My BBC rates are 0.053% of what Ricky Gervais's Netflix ones are. Right, so... I'm not,
I'm not trying to say like you're this or you're that.
Yeah, so it doesn't add up to anything. Really.
I hear what you're saying. It's not me saying like you're this or that. I'm saying is what the perception is.
Yeah, well, the perception it doesn't.
Because I can only be honest to what people, like when I was open mic here, people would say, oh, he's copying Stuart Lee. That was a commonly used turn of phrase, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, I also think that I'm lucky. In that I'm the best known of a certain school of comics, you know. And I remember Sean saying to me before he died, obviously, didn't say it. But I did some podcast with him and he said, the problem is, he went, they think they've got one of us now and it's you, right? And you're on the telly doing your long stories and ideas and things, which is great. But it means the other people that do that space has gone. And certainly... I heard about another sort of comic of my type, you know, and they had their BBC Two pitch turned down because the then head of BBC Two, she went, we've got Stuart Lee and, Charlie Brooker for that sort of thing, so we don't need any more, like, people with ideas talking about, you know. So it's sort of, I think I've clogged the thing up. So, you know, really, what I tried to do with Alternative Comedy Experience that you mentioned earlier was put on all those kind of comics that are sort of a bit other.
Yeah,
you know,
and they were great comics, man. You had Tony Law,
Hemingway,
Henning Vane,
Vane. And then people did see it and go, oh wow, I didn't know, you know, those were there. Then there was a lot of sort of controversy about it afterwards, none of which had anything to do with me. But people were going, oh well, lots of those people have been on other things and whatever. But there was, I think, it did have a sort of, it had a sort of aesthetic on some level, and you know, and I also, I'm heavily in debt to all those people, because my influences are the people I've seen on the fringe for 30 years. You know, my influences are my contemporaries as well, like Daniel Kitson and Harry Hill and Paul Sinner and great. Whatever. You know, they're
all great, fantastic comedians.
You kind of feel like you're part of that, really. Where I'm lucky is that I can probably get through to 65 writing a new tour show every couple of years. And if the audience tails off by 25% every time I tour and I never do any more telly, I'll still get... Yeah. It'll still be viable to retire.
Still paying bills.
Yeah, which is a really weird thing to think, you know.
One thing I really enjoyed you made one time, and it's because I met the guy and he's a lovely man. It's the little mini doc you made about, is it Phil Chippendale?
Oh, Ted Chippington,
Ted Chippington.
Did you meet him?
Yeah, I met him.
Where did you meet him?
He used to come around the Comedy Caf. Because I remember he used to knock around. You know, so the Comedy Caf was a club in Shoreditch.
Yeah.
And it was in the upstairs.
Right.
And that's where I started out. That's where I basically...
Right, so what sort of top of year was that then?
This was maybe... So I was about 21. No, about 22, 23. Yeah. I'm 27 now, so about...
Oh, right.
Yeah, so
a few years ago. He turned up there,
didn't and you'd knock around a bit.
I wonder why he was in London.
Because I remember... he never really went on.
No, he wouldn't.
He wouldn't go on, he would just knock around.
He didn't like doing comedy clubs.
I think he knew Noel.
No Faulkner.
Oh, he might have done, yeah.
He knew from No Faulkner, yeah. So he would come down, he would watch from the back.
Right.
And yeah, but anyway, it was really sweet, it was really nice.
Yeah,
but it was all that, like, talking about the tree of alternative comedy, yeah, and going, well, this guy is a branch.
Yeah, but it's a branch that would never went
anywhere. Yeah, and it was a branch that never went anywhere. Yeah, but yeah. It's like, he used to just make people furious.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful. And yeah. It was, you know, and as a comedian.
Well, that's
it
was why great he didn't really do. He liked to go on at places where he wasn't expected.
No, like, or wanted.
Yeah. Actually, which is probably where I got the idea for the original comedy vehicle idea of, like, beyond where you'll go down badly, because my favourite recordings of Ted are of him going down badly, because he's going down badly in a way that a comic, you're going, oh, you're doing that so brilliantly.
Yeah, yeah,
you're making it sort of worse in a really... My favourite bit is where it's on an album called Man in a Suitcase, and it's the audience going, who the fuck? Who the fuck? Who the fucking hell are you? Who the fucking hell are you? And after each, he waits for it all to go, and he goes, Ted Chippington. And then they do it again. And he just answers the question each time, as if it were meant in a spirit of inquiry, which, again, I realise is something that I've got from him, is a treat heckles as if they were questions.
Yeah, genuine
not
questions.
As if they were, why don't you fuck off? Well, I'm contracted to be here for 20 minutes. I can't just go. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, because actually, what do they want? Because I kind of think if you do a put down, you're then like, oh, I'm a comedian,
yeah.
And then, you know, but it's which you can do. I mean, yeah. There's all these some podcast blokes from, there seem to be sports presenters, and they review comedy. They were one of them had watched Comedy Vehicle, and there's a bit where a bloke walks out, and I go, I can't believe you're leaving. This is a live recording. I mean, my career stands or falls on this, and you're making me look terrible. And he's going, why did he do that? Why didn't he go, oh, you're going off for a wank or something? And I go, well, he doesn't seem to know how to deal with walkouts. Of course I know how to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I've chosen to do something that's funny different. About me. It's a weird thing. I love Ted. I mean, Ted was, like, for me, was what you were saying about, you know, seeing things that make you want to do stuff. It was, I saw him opening for a band, and it made me think that you could do stand-up in all sorts of ways. Because I thought I liked comedy, but I thought I'd never be one of those, like, a showbiz person. Mm. And I saw him do it, and it didn't seem to be working at all, but it was really funny. I thought, oh, you can do whatever you want. And that's a great thing, free. That is still true, isn't it, of it? Even though I've been moaning like an old man. Oh, you can't melt ice anymore on stage for an hour. You have to speak. But actually, it is still... really free
well,
thing.
I mean, I try to look at it two ways.
Yeah.
And this is just me as, like, a young comic, you know, so please tell me if I'm talking shit. Just be like, Jamali, don't know what the fuck you're talking about. But there is a certain sense of, even though I like hearing, you know, and I think that, and a little part of me feels a bit sad that it doesn't happen anymore, and hearing the stories of it.
Yeah.
But in the same time, that stuff is still around because it's that builds the lineage. And I think there's a certain sense of there's a certain sense of that. I feel sometimes there's a generational gap with comedians and of the ages. So you got younger comedians need to understand without the older comedians, there ain't no fucking us.
Mm.
And you need to show some respect for that. You know what I mean? Without them, there isn't us. They've paved the way for us. And older comedians got to realize that, you know, comedy changes and things evolve.
Yeah.
And I think there needs to be more, you know, that we're all trying to achieve the same thing.
You know who's very good at that? It's Barry Cryer, who's like two generations before me. And Barry Cryer was, you know, mainly a comedy writer in the 50s and 60s. And he is 80-odd now. And he has kept all over the game, you know. And he knows who everyone is, young people. And
I've met Barry Cryer. Do you know, I did a charity gig where I was the youngest person by like 25 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was like Barry Cryer and all these type of rats. And he was lovely.
Yeah, well, he's
proper old school showbiz.
He was told that he was irrelevant when the 60s satire boom happened, and then he was told he was irrelevant again when alternative comedy happened. But he sees it all as part of a continuum, and it is really interesting talking to him because there are always things that pass on. And you know, I sort of was of a generation where I thought, you know, alternative comedy 1980 was a sort of ground zero thing, bang, you know, it's all started from scratch. Then you listen to Lenny Bruce from the 50s and 60s, and you go, right, he's done loads of things that I thought I had
thought up, right? Mm. Then you might, then you listen to some bit of music hall. I started listening to a lot of Max Miller from the 30s, right? Mm. And there's so many things about it that are really like what we do now. Mm. In fact, this idea of talking to the audience at home, he did that all the time. He does it to imaginary people that are behind the curtain, like he's talking to them about how terrible the audience out front are. And I'm not sure, again, I didn't get that from a 1930s Max Miller bit, you know. Yeah. Where, and in fact, sometimes, to amuse myself, I do those bits sort of in the voice of Max Miller, and no one's ever really noticed, but I do it as a private joke. I'm doing a joke from 90 years ago, basically.
Yeah.
No, in fact, the music hall stuff is a bit of a thing of mine, because living in Stoke Newington, a lot of the 19th century comics are buried in Abney Park Cemetery, and I like to go and look at their graves, particularly the one... I can't remember what he's called, and he's got a massive... He was huge, and he's got a... Herbert, and he's got a massive marble pillar as high as this room, and it's got all bushes have grown round it. You can't even get to it anymore. It's got comedian written on it. It's an irrelevant thing of a forgotten man. But it's good. Great. I like going around there. I've got all the, and when I'm backstage in the provincial theatres, I try and find bills from the 19th century and think what comedians were here in 1870. Yeah. And I was sitting in Wolverhampton, and Fred Barnes had been there. The Duke of Solihull, he was called, and I grew up in Solihull, so I always found that quite funny. Fred Barnes was the first out gay sort of stand-up, but he wasn't allowed to be out. He had to sing funny songs about it. He used to do an act with a marmoset on a lead, but he died as an alcoholic in Southend in the 30s, and he used to go around the pubs with a chicken on a lead, trying to remind people that he'd once been the marmoset on a lead guy. Really sad story. And I was thinking, oh, he was really something when he was here. You know, he lost all his work after he was involved in a scandal for driving around with a sailor in a car, and neither of them had their shirts on. That's what brought you down in that.
Yeah, that was the career ender.
Yeah, in 1910 or whatever. But I thought, I wonder if you can. You know, I went on eBay. I was sitting in the room where he would have sat. Wolverhampton Grand Dress. I went on eBay and there was like a signed photo of him for £2 or something, and I put it up in the toilet. But they're all sort of there, those people. Yeah. And the sad thing is, the material's lost, because the songs are still there. You can find recordings of the songs. Earl Oakin's got loads of them on wax cylinders, but what you haven't got is the bits between the songs, which was
the comedy.
Yeah, and I just thank God, what did we lose? And even the 80s alternative scene, nobody was filming it, you know. Yeah. There's very little.
I would love to have seen that old Mark Thomas tape or something like that. Or like, you know, some of the stories you hear, like, I'd love to have seen the Mark Thomas sort of
people didn't have camera phones and no one knew it was, you know.
Yeah. It was like around the test bar. But I just want to, I think I'm going to wrap it up here. I just want to say thank you, man. And I know
thanks for having me on.
And I know you're a humble dude, but I really appreciate your work, man.
That's very
and
kind of you. You know, I've really enjoyed watching everything the last couple of days, actually, of particularly the stuff of talking to all these people, and then, but I like the fact that you stand there and listen to them, and then you think, right, I'll go and write a routine taking the piss out of them, but I won't say it to their face.
Yeah.
They've got guns.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not stupid. But yeah, man. Thank you so much, and thank you for coming down. And I know you're a busy man, and I look forward to seeing more of your work, back and look at old stuff. So. If anyone who hasn't seen Stuart Lee, number one, you need to sort that the fuck out, and you need to go watch Comedy Vehicle. Like, that's probably the great starting point, because that's an amazing show. So thank you so much for coming, man. Appreciate you, boss. Thank you. That was Stuart Lee. We recorded like an hour and a half, and I think we're going to pull out the long version of that, because that was great. It was mad speaking to him. You know, being in the presence of experience and sort of just knowledge of comedy, and sort of a real creative mind for comedy, and sort of really taking comedy to the art form of comedy. And it's, you know, he's an amazing comedian. If you haven't seen his stuff, you know, check out Comedy Vehicle. It was on the BBC. Try and check out the alternative comedy show they did on Comedy Central, where you had great comedians down. And a lovely guy too. He was sporting a great beard, a very underrated beard. I should have mentioned his beard. It was a good beard. And I was just in awe, you know, listening to his ideas and his theories about comedy. And, you know, it was definitely a me listening podcast as opposed to me talking, which I enjoyed. But yeah, the next person I got on the podcast is Getz. So you want to check in that one. That's this one I'm probably most excited for. He's, you know, one of the
probably the best MCs that have this country's ever created, in my opinion. Check that out. I've got Getz coming on the podcast next. And catch me on tour. That's it, really. Come see me on the tour. I'm going to be doing, all around the country. I'll be doing some American dates. Australia, I'll be putting out soon. So, yeah, come catch me on tour. My name's been Jamali Mann. This has been The Breakdown in association with The Hook.
Jamali 9000. Jamali 9.
Jamali.
Jamali 9000 from Mars. Just land over Max with the computer. My wings expand on Earth, around the universe. The superhero just written a verse. The J on my shirt for Jamali. Never using a Molly. Walking down the galaxy, computers on my hand. Built in like I'm a man. Machine since I was growing up with children. Mechanical rapper putting a robot flow together. I made a steal in any weather. Disguised more than Spider-Man in a sweater. Optimist way after prime. Standing on top of the world, I gotta shine. Just like my pop's new Cadillac CT6. The patch on my eye, I be Rick. The lyrics are slick, like new now wave grease.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.